Gary was the most annoying person I had ever met in my life. He paid no attention to the people around him. He never learned from his mistakes. He would go and do the same thing over and over again. He wasn't a team player. I met Gary 20 years ago in an improv class. I wanted to be an actor back then. I wanted to be part of a group. I wanted to be funny. But I also wanted to be good, so I paid attention to the rules. I tried to get better and learn the craft. Gary, on the other hand, came in hot all the time. Offers would fly out of his pockets at a furious pace. Improv scenes would crumble the moment he entered and pulled imaginary typewriters and guns out of his pockets or out of thin air. It would have been infuriating if he wasn't such a sweet and kind person. Offstage Gary wasn't too off from onstage Gary, minus the bad object work. I've been thinking a lot about him lately because over the past couple months, I've found myself in several different conversations on the topic of authenticity. I couldn't stand working with Gary way back then because I felt like he stood in the way of me becoming something, whatever that was, a good improviser, success, funny. I don't really know, to be honest. But Gary didn't care about any of that. He was completely lacking in pretension. He was just having fun. Gary was a person who never tried to be anything he wasn't. He was pure and sincere in ways I couldn't be because, well, I was so desperate to be anything. I found myself to be a bore, so I needed to change. Gary performed with such joy, I wish I could go back and re-experience it. He was the most honest and authentic person I ever worked with, only I didn't realize it at the time. I'm thinking about him now as I try to impart that level of realness into the characters I write, and truly into myself and how I behave in real life. So, Gary, wherever you are, I hope you're still that same real, honest person you were 20 years ago, and I hope more of us can be more like you. My name is Brian James Polak, and this is The Subtext, brought to you by American Theater Magazine. If you're listening for the first time, The Subtext is a podcast where every month I sit down with another playwright for an hour, and we just talk. No script, no agenda, just a conversation. This month I speak with Chisa Hutchinson, whose play, Surely Goodness and Mercy, is currently running in New York City. I actually recorded this conversation with Chisa back in December at the National New Play Network Annual Showcase. It was recorded as part of a special NNPN episode I have in the works, so stay tuned for that. I've been blabbering a lot lately about leaving ratings and comments for this show on iTunes and elsewhere, and many of you generously responded. You all warm my heart. Thanks for helping spread the subtext around like a delicious European butter on artisan bread. By the way, if you're a Twitter user, you can find us at Subtext Podcast, and if you ever have something you want to say directly in an email, send it to thesubtextpodcast@gmail.com. To intro Chisa to you, I'm going to read a bit from the bio on her website because I think it's hilarious and wonderful. Chisa was born in Queens, New York, to young, irresponsible parents. She spent the majority of her formative years under the care of a much more responsible but chronically broke woman who was technically her godfather's mother, but who would later, in the fine It Takes a Village tradition of the broken family, simply become Ma. Chisa grew up in the company of what seemed like hundreds of unofficially adopted brothers and sisters in Newark, New Jersey, where she excelled in school and philosophized with cockroaches about the ultimate merits of poverty. Her favorite six-legged pest, who called himself Swifty on account of his uncanny ability to elude the bottom of any shoe, once told her with a wistful chuckle, "One day you will be able to look back and romanticize all this shit." Go to her website to read the rest. Here's my conversation with Chisa Hutchinson.
So, yeah, I'm an East Coast girl. I learned that the hard way.
Where are you living now?
So I live in Newark, New Jersey now.
Yeah.
Which is about 25 minutes southwest-ish of New York City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where'd you grow up?
In Newark, New Jersey for the most part.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I was born in New York, and then my dad stayed in Queens. And then I lived... It's a very long...
Yeah?
Very long, complicated story. I have... My granddad used to joke. He's like, yeah, you don't have a family tree. You have a family forest. And I'm like, that about...
So does that mean, that like, about gets does that mean there are a lot of people and they're all over the place?
Yeah, I have a lot of parents. I kind of got passed around a bunch, you know, because my biological parents were really young and kind of dumb when they had me.
Yeah, yeah.
So they gave me to this nice lady in Newark, mm-hmm. New Jersey, and I grew up, for the most part, with her.
Yeah.
Until about the age of 14, when I got a scholarship to go to what I thought was a boarding school, but turns out it wasn't.
What was it?
I didn't know that until after I accepted the scholarship and everything, and I'm doing this program that's like supposed to prepare you to go to the boarding schools and la 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 la. And while I'm there, New Jersey Seeds is the scholarship program, which is also Newark-based, right? So I'm like going to this program. I'm like almost done with it. I'm getting ready to go to this new school in September. And they invited this child psychologist to come in and talk to us about what it was going to be like to be different at our new, you know, our swanky new schools. Because, you know, we're all like inner city kids.
Yeah.
Half of us never met a white person in our life. You know, like,
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
So she comes in and she is, in fact, a white person. She's like this. She's like, like PhD Barbie, you know, she's like tall, blonde, really pretty, blue eye, you know, she comes in and she's telling us what it's like to be different. And, you know, she would know because she was an exchange student in Argentina 1 year of her high school career. Right. So we're like, I'm looking at her and I'm like,
and you're 14 at the time.
And I'm 14 and I'm thinking something smart ass like, like, bitch, we don't have to leave the country to feel out of place, you know,
right.
Like and I think I said something to that effect because I'm a little smart ass.
Yeah.
And so she sought me out after the our little session with her, and she sat with me and my friend at lunch, and she's asking us, oh, what school are you going to next year? And I told her, I said, oh, yeah, I'm going to Kent Place next year. And she goes, oh, Kent Place. Why Kent Place? Why'd you choose Kent Place? I said, oh, it seems like a nice boarding school, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And she goes, oh, it's not a boarding school. And I'm like, well, what do you mean? It's not a boarding school, you know? And she's like, well, I would know. I have two daughters who go there. And I'm like, oh. All right, well, this kind of throws a wrench in my plan to, like, get out of the hood. I was in, like, the hoodest hood of Newark, New Jersey.
But that was it. Like, you saw boarding school as...
Well, any school with, like, multiple buildings and, like, a campus, of
But
course,
also living,
school,
living
right?
there was, like...
Yeah, like, living there was going to be my way out. That was, like, okay, one less mouth to feed for my mom because she was taking in kids the way other people take in stray cats, you know?
Yeah.
Like, she had such a big heart, but, like, a small budget, you know?
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, I'll get this scholarship to go to this boarding school. I'll have my meals there, you know, whatever. I'll come home for holidays, yada, yada. And then so to find out that it wasn't a boarding school, so now I'm like, shit, I'm going to have to find a way to, like, get there somehow. And it was only, like, 10 miles away, but, I couldn't even afford a bus pass
That's
to get to,
far,
like,
man.
It's far,
yeah.
Right? So I'm like, shoot, what do I do? So then, like, everybody in the program is, like, running around, like, trying to figure out, well, maybe you can live with my grandparents. My grandparents live in Summit, New Jersey, which is where school is. You know, you maybe go live with them while you go to high school. And, you know, people are, like scrambling because they know my situation. They're like, oh, you can't stay where you are. Like, it was crazy. So anyway, so... A couple of weeks later, like a few days before the program is ending, right, I'm still trying to figure this out, the dean of the program brings me in and he's like, so you hit the jackpot. I'm like, what do you mean? He's like, you know that lady who came in to talk to you guys, the psychologist? I'm like, PhD Barbie, yeah, yeah. He's like, well, she she talked it over with her family, and they think that you should come live with them while you go to Kent Place. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. In Short Hills, New Jersey, which is what it sounds like, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, Short Hills, you know. So I moved in at 14. I moved in with this very wealthy white family to Short Hills, New Jersey.
Who you had this, like, smart-ass exchange
yeah,
with.
Yeah, I know, right? But she was so cool. She's still so cool. She's, like, my mom now. Like,
yeah.
She's like all the mom I have left now, because my mom passed away in 2011. But and I don't really know my biological mother all that well still, who's down in Atlanta. We're Facebook friends though, so that's cool. but yeah, so I call her my woke white mom, Kristen Peck, pain in the neck.
Oh yeah.
She's like the coolest, wokest lady, and like the whole family, because she has three kids, three biological kids, and her husband at the time, Kenny Goldman, he was really cool too. I just went to his wedding because he remarried.
Yeah.
But yeah, the whole family is really chill. They're really cool. I learned a lot at that school.
Were you the same age as her daughter, her biological children?
Nope. So her kids, I was 14. Her oldest was 9.
Oh, okay.
Girl, Hannah. And then Elliot, the boy, was 6. And the little girl, Claire, was 3 or 4 at the time. And I think I just fucked them all the way up. Like,
yeah.
I think I just, like, came in and it was like, who's this person?
Just your presence being there?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that it was a little odd or,
yeah.
You know, a little, I mean, certainly a change, you
yeah.
know? Especially for the oldest, who had been the oldest, you know? And so in comes this 14-year-old, and it's like, well, what does this mean for...
Yeah.
Like, you're messing with the natural order of things here. So yeah, it was a rough transition, I think, for, like, everybody involved. But I, you know, we've really kind of grown to love and respect each other. And,
yeah.
You know, support each other where we can. And
I mean, was the school similar?
The school was a great place to learn how to write an
was
essay.
It like Short Hills school? You know, was it the same sort of like white bread situation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, the family was chill.
Right.
Pretty progressive. I mean, obviously, you know, like pretty progressive, pretty open-minded and all that. The school was a little more conservative.
Yeah.
And by a little more, I mean a lot more, was very conservative. I actually almost got kicked out of that school because I got upset at a school dance. The DJ, there's like the school dance, because it was an all-girls school, so we had a lot of dances. And, you know, all the little black girls would like sit together at one table and like we would every now and then run up to the DJ and like request some, you know, can you play some you know, something that isn't like
right.
Come On Eileen or like Brown Eyed Girl for the third time, you know? So
yeah.
We would run up and like make these requests, and at first the DJ's like, oh yeah, I have that, whatever, I'll get to it. And then we're noticing like he's really not, you know, responding to us. And then got to a point
we're
where
hearing
we would
Madonna
go up
for the 14th time.
Yeah. And he would literally just ignore us. So I got really upset. I got like upset to the point where I was like kind of hyperventilating and had to be escorted out of the gym. But you know, eventually they calm me down, whatever. I go back into the gym and have a good time for as best a time as I can at mm-hmm. like dancing to Come On Eileen. Come to find out, like years later, she didn't tell me this until like years after the fact, but apparently what happened, one of the chaperones, a parent who was chaperoning the dance, you know, saw me kind of freaking out and was like, this is clearly a drug-induced rage. She is, like, totally drugged out, and I'm a doctor, so I would know. And I don't want my daughter associating with anyone like this. And I'm, you know, and she apparently, like, drew up a petition and circulated it amongst, like, the sort of more conservative parents of the school and presented it to the head of the school to get me kicked out.
And you had no idea?
I had no idea any of this was happening. I had no idea. I was, like, blissfully unaware. Because I was already, like, angry and militant. So Chris was probably like, we should probably not bring this up. But, yeah, the headmistress called up my mom and was like, so there's this petition to get Shisa kicked out of school. Because they think she's a druggie basically. And, I would like to hold a meeting with you and these other parents who are concerned about her alleged drug use. And man, Chris went in, she bless her heart. She went in there like PhD blazing. And she was just like, all right, I'm ready. She was like ready to go to battle. Right. None of the other parents showed up. So Chris is sitting there by herself, you know, looking at the headmistress like, mm-hmm. And she's like, so I think they're not here because this is some racist bullshit and they know it. And if you kick my daughter out of the school, I'm going to hit you with a lawsuit so fast it'll make your head spin. So I got to, like, continue my tenure
right.
at Kent Play School and, like, graduate with honors in 3 subjects and the Citizenship Cup. Thank you very much.
That's amazing for somebody that was so whacked out on drugs.
Right? I know. Meanwhile, like, I can't even take an Advil without, like, reading the label twice. So, you know, I was, yeah, like, the straight edge kid. Like, I never got invited to the parties where everybody was, like, drinking and whatever all. And, like, these girls are doing all kinds of drugs. I mean, seriously, like, I had too much to lose. I was a scholarship kid, you know? And
yeah,
I really believed in the whole, like, don't do drugs, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I listened, you know? Stay in school, don't do drugs. Like, that was,
yeah,
you know? We just have, you know, all the black kids at that school, you know? We had too much to prove to be, like, messing around. So we were the straight edge kids.
Right.
We're not the ones that...
You were straight edge because you had to be.
Needed to be concerned about.
If you weren't,
yeah,
it would have been hell to pay.
I mean, apparently we don't have to do much of anything, mm-hmm, other than, like, get upset, you know, over some bullshit to, like, get potentially kicked out of the school. So, but I stayed, and you know, I learned a lot about writing. I learned about theater because I had never really been exposed to theater before I went to school.
Before you came to the school, you had, like...
Before the school, theater was, like, dead white guys, you know, white guys in tights on stage spewing thee and thou and whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and Shakespeare, like, that was it, you know? And I didn't really think of theater as something that was, like, that I could do.
Right.
Until I got to Kent Place and I had a really badass theater teacher, Mr. Pridham, Bob Pridham. he passed a little while ago. But we kept in touch long after I graduated.
So he broke it open for you?
Totally broke it wide open. Well, he only taught acting, like acting and improv classes. That was like the gateway activity. So mm-hmm. everybody started out acting with the theater. And I was noticing, like, come monologue time, you know, because we'd have to perform a monologue for our final or whatever. It was like, okay, well, I can do Benita from Raisin in the Sun or...
Right, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So I started writing my own material, or like material, because there were other black girls in the program also, you know, so I would be writing monologues for them and writing, you know, and for myself. And
what were you writing?
That's
Do you
how
remember
I started
what you were
writing?
Writing
plays anyway. Yeah, I mean, vaguely. I don't even remember. I honestly don't remember, but I just... Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah,
but I'm sure it was horrible.
I'm sure it was genius.
No, but yeah, and he would like take us to go see. I got to see a cabaret with Alan Cumming in it.
Mm-hmm.
And Alan Cumming winked at me, and I just about peed myself. And then, what else did we see? One of Julie Taymor's earliest works, Juan Darien, this like puppet. I was like, puppet theater, what?
Yeah.
Right? And then, what else did we see? I got to see Twelfth Night. That was part of a prize that I won, like a theater prize. One of the theater prizes, and the prize was like two tickets to go see Twelfth Night. And I was like, oh, yes. and that was with Helen Hunt. So he really got me like, so interested. And I think, the most exciting thing that he did for me was take me, and it was just me specifically, to go see August Wilson debate Robert Brustein on the issue of colorblind casting. It blew my face off. I was there. So I was like, we were like up in the rafters,
incredible.
And it was packed. I mean, because this is when people like, you know, like really gave a shit about theater. So we're like sitting up in the rafter. I was like Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, just like leaning over the, you know, and I really found myself sort of gravitating toward August Wilson's point of view, you know, of like, hey, you know, colorblind casting, that's lazy, you know, like that's lazy as shit. That's just an excuse to not tell stories that are actually about people of color. You know, you can't just shoehorn actors of color into historically white roles and think that you've done something, you know, and think that that's inclusion. Or,
well, if you're gaming, you know, out colorblind casting and you're applying it to August Wilson's plays, you're suddenly saying, look, I can cast anybody in Fences, right?
Exactly. And you're erasing, like the experiences, the very particular experiences of an entire race of people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So while I do believe, because, you know, actors, talent, there's really gifted, really talented actors of color. And of course, like, if you want to rock Hamlet, cool, you know, I don't think it's an either or kind of situation. I think it's an and situation, you know, and we need to be telling stories that are actually about people of color.
Sure.
Yeah, that's where I heard this and I was like, yes, yes. And
do you remember Robert Brustein's point of view, his side of the argument?
Not really.
Yeah.
I think he was more along the lines of, you know, oh, well, these are the universal stories.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, you can't see, I'm crossing my eyes because I can't stand that universal. Yeah, these are human stories. They're universal stories, so anyone can be a vehicle for them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, But there is something to be said about specificity.
Sure.
You know, and there is value in it, you know, to not try to just, you know, only focus on commonality, you know, like I don't necessarily go to the theater to, you know, just have my experience reinforced. God, if that were the case, like I'd have been starved for that. I'd have been out of theater like long ago, like before I even started, you know, because there was nothing that reflected my experience on stage, you know. So I can't. The common ground is not the only place we can stand, you know. We can wander on over to you know, to other territories and check that out and see how, I don't know, and kind of relish the differences and maybe even find something that works a little bit better, or that, you know, there's strength in diversity. You know, and I know that there are a lot of people who need to be convinced of that. And I think that the best way to do that is to actually honor that diversity on stage, in our stories, you know, on stage, under the lights. And
I'd say if people still need to be convinced of that, they're beyond convincing.
I can't believe that.
Maybe I'm cynical.
I don't blame you. I really don't, because, I mean, what's today? Today's Saturday. Tuesday, I'll probably feel... Tuesday will probably be my cynical day, where I feel like, oh God, there's no getting through to anybody else. But you know, but today I feel optimistic, and I feel like theater is one of these weird it's a shortcut, you know, for people who are tired of explaining things until they're blue in the face, mm-hmm. you know, I really think that sometimes, every now and then, like some a theater can just do something that just can shoot a very direct arrow, mm-hmm. you know, into someone's soul and change something, you know. My breakout play, the first play that I had produced and published, She Like Girls, had a workshop reading at the Lark Play Development Center mm-hmm. in New York. And I invited my ma, my black mom, not my biological mom, but the lady that she gave me to.
Right. Newark mom.
Newark mom, who was like very Christian, very, you know, had very particular ideas about what penises and vaginas are for, mm-hmm. right? She was asking me, you know, what I was up to, and said, "Oh, I have this reading of this play coming up in New York. You should come see it. I would love it. It's only one night, but, you know, I would love it if you could make." And she's like, "Oh, really? Oh, great. What's it called?" I said, "She Like Girls." And she was like, yeah, I don't know that I'm going to be able to make it, but, you know, but good luck and, you know, call me and let me know how it goes and all this stuff. And I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, I was a little hurt, but then I got a production of the play and, right. you know, that's like weeks long. So I'm like, so am I.
It's not one night. Yeah.
It's not one night. I'm sure you can find some time to come through. And she was, you know, she was like, okay, I'll come.
Yeah.
So she came. She came, and at the performance where we, you know, that we attended, there was a standing ovation at the end. First of all, like, the play, of course, is called She Like Girls. You know, it's about this girl. It's inspired by Sakia Gunn, who she was a Newark girl who was 15 years old, identified as lesbian, and was standing at a bus stop when some dude rolled up on her and tried to holler at her. She wasn't having it. She was like, whatever. I don't think my girlfriend would appreciate me talking to you or whatever. Right. And he stabbed her to death. And I didn't even hear about this, despite the fact that I am from Newark, right? I didn't even hear about it until like two years after the fact. It took me 2 years to hear about this. It took 2 years and like an LGBTQ advocate coming to the school where I taught at the time to shine a light on this. And I was like, how did I not know about this? So I wrote a play to kind of honor her life, her experience. And, you know, it's called She Like Girls. And and there is, in fact, a girl that she likes in it. and they, like, kiss on stage and everything. And my mom is watching this, and she's, like, ugh, you know, wincing and cringing. And it's just so painful for her. And at the end, we got a standing ovation. And my mom remained seated. And she's sitting there politely, sort of golf clapping. And, you know, when the applause dies down, she looks over at me and she goes, "I don't know where you come up with this stuff." And that was all she could say about the play for like, about a week, right? And then like a week later, she calls, and I still have this voicemail. I have it saved as an MP3 on my computer. She called, and she left me this voicemail that was like, "So I didn't get the chance to talk to you after." I'm like, "Yeah, you didn't get the chance to talk to me after." "So I didn't get the chance to talk to you after, but, you know, I went home and I read your little note from the playwriter." That's what she called me. Uh-huh. The little note from the playwriter. And, you know, I didn't know anything about the girl who had gotten killed because I had, you know, I explained what the impetus for the play was. And she was saying, like, I hadn't heard anything about it. You know, I was talking to other people, and some people knew, but a lot of people didn't. And, you know, I just want to say, And, you know, she was kind of fumbling for words. And she, I just want to say that, you know, I'm really proud of you. And, you know, to keep doing what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing and seek God. And, you know, I love you, I love you, I love you. And that was it. And I was like, oh, like, right. Like, that's why I do theater, you know? Like, that's why I need to keep doing this. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, you can change someone's mind. You know, you can change their heart. And, like, some months later, actually, my sister kicked her son out. He was, like, 16 at the time. Kicked her son out because she caught him kissing a boy, and mom took him in. And I'm not going to take full credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I like to think I made it a little bit easier. So, yeah, I think that there's a chance, you know, if it's a, there are big problems, you know, that we've got big problems as humans, right? And all I have is words. I'm not good at anything else, you know, I'm not really particularly interested in anything else, you know, so if there is anything that I can do with these words to, like, help fix a problem,
mm-hmm.
you know, or to, like, help at least make other people who have great ideas feel prepared or feel bolstered or feel supported while they go out into the world to fix the problems, then okay, cool, I'm ready to do that. I'm ready to, like, offer up all my little words, you know, and, like, mm-hmm. here, just take them, and I hope they help, you know. Godspeed.
Yeah.
How did you
come to realize that you could do this, or this was the thing that you could do?
That experience with my mom was, like, huge. Was huge. I mean, even earlier, like, seeds were, I guess, starting to get planted, particularly at the school that I mentioned, Kent Place.
Who was somebody? Was this teacher feeding you?
Mr. Pridham.
Was Mr. Pridham feeding you as a writer?
Yes, a little bit, but he was more focused. He was more trying to help me with, like, you know, your protagonist should want something, you know, like that kind of stuff, like craft stuff. And he wasn't really thinking necessarily in terms of, like, you know, theater as a weapon that, you know, you can wield, or like a tool that you can use to sort of excavate some truth that people might find helpful. Yeah, I guess I didn't really, I don't know, I guess instinctively I started doing it because I saw, again, like, I saw people just not acknowledging that people like me existed.
Mm-hmm.
Or just little things, little microaggressions that, like, made me realize, like, oh, I gotta get our stories out there. Because otherwise people are gonna, I'm trying to think of, like, how, because you can't assume that people, you know, share your values, you know, you can't assume that everyone thinks, again, like, diversity is a good thing, or that, like, you know, you should give a shit about people who are different from you, right? And so I'm always thinking of, like, how can I convince those people whose values are very different from mine to give a shit about my values, or to at least acknowledge that, like, they're valid, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you should care about Black people, poor Black people in particular, because, I mean, like, look at Nike.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Look at Nike taking a stand, you know, with Colin Kaepernick, which is, like, major, you know, and it was also calculated. I think a lot of us would like to think that, like, oh, yes, it's because they share our values. Right. It's because they believe, you know, that, you know, police brutality is bad, blah, 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 like, whatever. Right. And that, you know, oh, freedom of speech and yada, yada. That's cool and all, but I would wager that, you know, they did the math.
Sure, it was calculated.
They know who's buying their shit, so
they could have said nothing.
Yeah, Yeah.
Right? Because what did Adidas say? Right? What did Saucony say? What did all these brands say? Mm-hmm. Nothing.
Mm-hmm. But you know what? Like, the types of people, the types of folks who, like, are really into Colin Kaepernick or who are, like, supporting him, we got spending power, first of all, you know? And we tend to lean Nike-ward already.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm not a sneaker person. I don't use... like, I don't really wear sneakers. I got like 3 pairs of Nikes now, you know, because I want to pat Nike on the back, not necessarily for like, oh, doing the right thing and like whatever, but I mean, they did do the right thing, but like, I think, but not necessarily because they share my values, but because they acknowledge that like, there's this population here. They acknowledge our power, mm-hmm. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, yes, that, I trust that, you know, like I trust that as a motivation. Mm-hmm. I trust that as, you know, if you, like Hollywood is kind of doing the same thing right now. I was just having this discussion like earlier. The difference between like theater and Hollywood as far as like diversity is concerned, right? So theater, we got all the language. We know how to talk about diversity. We know how to talk about, you know, the value of equity and inclusion and all that, right? We got the jargon. We got that down.
Mm-hmm.
And we have conferences and we have affinity groups and we have, you know, we have all this stuff. But then you look at what's getting produced on stage, you know, like here... Like, you know, like how many, I've got plays that like, they've been read to death everywhere, but like nobody is producing them. I'm like, well, clearly people are responding to the story. Well, why isn't it getting produced? You know, why are we producing the same, like 3 white guys, you know, all over the country? And meanwhile, you've got Hollywood, who, you know, they're so not PC. Like, I've taken a couple of meetings. Like, I haven't worked in TV or whatever, but I've written some screenplays and, you know, had conversations with people that have made me raise brow a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, the things that they say, and you're like, I don't, ooh, you just, oh, you missed that memo. Or, like, you know, you like, didn't get the... Ooh, you know, just the language that they have to talk about like diversity and whatever. But I, in a way, in a weird way, I trust them more because they're putting their money where their mouth isn't, you know, like they're recognizing that like people are buying, like there's a market for stories about people who aren't like manic pixie dream girls, you know, or like, you know, or like, they're insecure, Atlanta, like, you know, like there are all these, well, that's not Hollywood, that's TV, but like,
it's still the same system.
It's still the same system, right?
System that is allowing
Empire super successful.
Empire, you know? And Atlanta to happen is allowing Black Panther to happen.
Yeah, Black Panther, Hidden Figure, you know, like all these sort of surprise hit. And I'm like, I don't understand how this is surprising, but okay, you know, Crazy Rich Asians, like, cool.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm like so happy that these films and these shows are doing well. Because, you know, the Hollywood, you know, the execs and whoever all are looking at it, and maybe they don't necessarily believe that, like, oh, yes, diversity for diversity's sake, kind of, you know, like, they're not...
Are you saying it's ironic that Hollywood is taking these chances
of, is ahead
in theater,
of theater.
Isn't, despite theater being quote-unquote woke?
Yes, yes. I'm saying that I trust those motivations more. And like when I write, I really try to take into consideration like how to keep appealing to those folks who, again, who like, who think differently from me, or like who maybe don't, who if I didn't point it out, maybe wouldn't recognize the, the value in knowing about the experiences of, you know, I tend to write about like inner city Black people, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, you should know about their experiences so you don't piss them off and have them boycott your company, for mm-hmm. example. You know what I mean? So I'm always thinking about like how can I get through to you so you A, stop taking us for granted, B, don't piss us off. mm-hmm. Like, you know, and C, maybe even like see the benefit of trying to appeal to us or trying to offer us something, you know, or take our experiences into account. Like, how can I get you thinking about us, you know, in a way that is respectful, even if it's not the warm and fuzzy, like, oh, we should all just like love each other, la la la, right? Because, you know, execs aren't thinking of that. You know, the CEOs of big ass companies aren't thinking about that. Like the people who are in positions where they can hire people, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people who are in positions where they can promote one cause or another, right?
Mm-hmm.
The people who are in those positions aren't necessarily, they don't necessarily share our ideals. But if we could convince them that, like, if we could somehow convince them that, like, our, that those ideals are actually worth something, even if it's just, like, to their bottom line,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? Again, like, I trust that.
Like, you don't have to necessarily appeal to their emotions.
Right. Or yes, appeal to their emotions, but, like, do it to some concrete end.
Something tangible that they can understand.
Yeah, right? Or yeah, something that, like...
It'll feel good, and it will also help you do the other things you want to do.
Exactly, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Here's why you should give a shit about us, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's... I feel like my job as a playwright is to, like... get people who would not ordinarily give a shit about the people I write about
mm-hmm.
to give a shit about them,
yeah.
Right? I just, this is weird. I just wrote a play for a commission from South Coast Rep. That's a revenge horror
mm-hmm.
play. And it's about, you know, this, like, quirky white chick who's just, like, which I never write about quirky white chicks. It's about this quirky white chick who is, like, just living her life, you know, like, building dollhouses and, you know.
Like you do.
Looking for love in all the wrong places, you know, when suddenly, like, weird supernatural shit starts happening to her. And she can't for the life of her figure out why, right? Well, it's because... she like casually called the cops on the neighborhood, well, for lack of as a shortcut, I'll just say the
right.
neighborhood crazy lady, right?
Right?
So she has moved into this neighborhood in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn, which is like pretty diverse, right? But she's moved in and she's just calling the police on everybody, right? And she called the police on the one lady who, you know, kind of wanders the neighborhood. Everybody knows her story.
Sure, yeah.
Everybody knows her. Nobody calls the cops on Miss Yvette, you know? Like, nobody calls the cops on her. Like, what are you doing? But she calls the cops on Miss Yvette, and Miss Yvette gets carted off to the nut house and, you know, never to be seen or heard from again until weird supernatural shit starts happening.
Yeah.
And I wrote the play because... I mean, obviously, there's this rash of, like, these white chicks who are just frivolously calling the cops on, you know, the way you might ask to speak to a manager at the Walmart, you know. They're just, like, calling the cops on, well, you know, they're out here being, you know. She's taking a nap on this, you know, lounge in her dorm, you know. He's walking into his own apartment. Like,
yeah.
Literally, like, Black people are getting the cops called on them for, like, walking into their own apartments.
Right.
And it's getting fucking ridiculous, you know? And I just, sometimes there are tragic consequences to that, you know. You know, people get shot. Mm-hmm. It can be a death sentence, you know. So to just call the cops on someone because, like, they are not even inconveniencing you, but just, like, living their lives, I don't know. Like, that just... there's something hateful about that. There's something really, I don't know, I feel evil about that, right? So, but like nobody's, there's no consequences for like, well, maybe there are now because they're getting a lot of attention, but like, you know, George Zimmerman is still walking around.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, living his life as such as it is at this point. But like, I have to imagine that like, even if there isn't like legal justice for people who ultimately fall victim to that kind of mentality of like, well, I'm just going to call the cops on this black person because they look suspicious to me. You mm-hmm. know, people who fall victim to that, even if they don't get legal justice, like I have to believe that there's some cosmic justice, you know, like I have to believe that there's some other force at work that like, I don't know, maybe makes life miserable for George Zimmerman, mm-hmm. or, you know, the George Zimmermans or the swimming pool Patties or whoever, the, you know, or what do they call her? Permit Patty and like...
Right. So that's what's happening with the supernatural.
So that's what's happening with this.
It's cosmic retribution.
It's cosmic retribution. Yeah. And, you know, it may not happen in the way that it happens in my play, but I do want to plant the seed, right, in people's heads, particularly maybe there are a couple of people sitting in the audience who like have at least been tempted to call the cops on people, or who have called the cops on people who were just living their lives, minding their business, maybe laughing on the train. I don't know, you know?
Like, and there's probably even a larger population of people. Maybe they haven't called the cops, mm-hmm. but maybe they've heard the story about somebody who has, and they are like, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I see why they do that.
Mm-hmm.
Excusing it, and not damning the behavior like they should be.
Yes, right. And this play, I hope, will make them rethink that, you know, and to just sort of make them think twice before they pick up the phone and dial their three favorite numbers.
Yeah. When you were coming up, when you were starting off as a writer, who were the gatekeepers? Who were the advocates for you? Who were the people that helped you, like, overcome the first obstacles that we all new playwrights have in mm-hmm. getting seen?
Mm-hmm. I mean, apart from Mr. Pridham, who was like, here is theater, enjoy.
Right. Yeah.
Well, when I was starting out, Tina Howe was like my first mentor.
Yeah.
And I met her through The Lark. Uh-huh. Which is like, that was like my first artistic home. I love The Lark. The Lark is like my jam. So, but I did Playwrights Week for The Lark, and then they invited me back for the round table, not round table, for, their bare bones production of She Like Girls, mm-hmm. actually. And Tina Howe came to that play. They hooked us up. They said, okay, mm-hmm. well, we're going to invite Tina to see your play. Maybe you guys can go and have dinner after or something.
Right.
And so that's what happened. And Tina, we went to the little Mexican restaurant that was like two doors down from The Lark at the time. Tina was, you know, I really liked the play. And we were just talking like all for like, I don't even know how long we sat in that restaurant. Mm-hmm. It was hours. But at that point I had missed the last train I think there was one train left. And like, if I didn't leave right then I was going to miss it kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Back to New Jersey. And she was like, oh, you're not going back to New Jersey. It's too late. It's super late right now. No, you're coming home with me.
What?
Tina, the day we met, Tina Howe was like, you're coming home with me. And I was like, oh, okay. And she's like, you can sleep in my daughter's room. She's not there, you know, whatever, whatever. So I went home with Tina Howe and we talked some more. And she was like, have you thought about grad school? Do you have an MFA? And I was like, no. And she's like, you need an MFA. You need to go to NYU. I'm going to write you a letter of recommendation. And I was like, oh, okay. Meanwhile, right, I think it was due like the very next day. The application at this point was like due the next day.
And you weren't even already thinking about it.
And I wasn't thinking about it. Tina Howe was just like, no, you need to apply. And I was like, oh, okay. So I literally put together a grad school application in like a day. Tina Howe wrote me a letter of recommendation. And I got into NYU. I got into NYU, like, full ride.
That's amazing.
Like, what? Like, who?
That's amazing.
How does that happen? And I, like, submitted the one play that I had, you know.
Well, that was that essentially the one play that you, like, was that your first play?
It was my first play that was, like, professionally done.
That people recognized.
I'd written a play in college.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was college
play. Right.
So, yeah, Tina Howe was, like, the first. That woman just kicked down the gates and was just mm-hmm. like, and here you go. Like, head on in. So, I mean, NYU, she, like, got me. She recommended me to Atlantic Theater Company, and they offered me a commission. Like, she was, like, she is fierce. She is a fierce advocate. And then I was really starting to realize, oh, you just need people to like advocate for your work. Like this is really cool. Okay, great. And then when I was in grad school, I had Diana San I took her master class. That woman is a fierce advocate too. She will like anything. She's so generous, you know. And she was talking about how she and Lynn Nottage are really good friends.
Yeah.
And I was such a huge fan of Lynn Nottage
at that point.
I was just like, oh my God, Lynn Nottage, you know. Oh. So come time for us to like get internships as part of our curriculum at NYU. I didn't want to like apply to, you know, I don't know, some company or other and like fetch coffee and make copies of scripts or whatever, you know. I don't want to do that. So I asked Diana Sun, I said, hey, do you think Lynn would be interested in like having an intern? Like a personal assistant maybe, you know, just sort of like help her out a little bit. And this is before she even won her first Pulitzer. And Diana was like, yeah, I could ask her. So she, of course, like, who's going to be like, no, I don't need a personal
free
assistant.
Free help?
I need a free help, you know? And so I cleared it with the department. I'm like, does this count as an internship? They were like, fuck yeah, that counts as an internship. I love NYU, man, because they're just, like, so flexible about stuff like that. They're like, yeah, sure, whatever, that counts. So, I signed up to be Lynn Nottage's personal assistant for the semester. And she was another super fierce. And, of course, then she won her Pulitzer. And
right.
She was, like, the busiest woman.
And you had a lot of work to do.
Yep, as and then I had so much work to do and so many emails to screen. And, like, it was a lot. It was a lot. But it was so worth it. And it was, and she's such a, like, her spirit, you know? Like, she's just such a warm and humble, you know, spirit, like, even after she won a freaking Pulitzer, you know, mm-hmm. she was just like, oh, yeah, okay, you know. And she, I mean, wrote me letters she was a reference for me for a very long time. I would say Tina Howe, Diana San, Lynn Nottage, David Henry Hwang is another, and I met him through the Lark also. I swear, I meet everybody through the Lark. Emily Morse at New Dramatists.
Yeah.
You know, oh goodness, like her, she's like just an angel. And who else? There's so many. those are the theater ones.
Sure.
And then you have like really sort of unlikely or like you just, I have this friend, Mark Woodcock, who is a photographer. And his, like, photographer name is Walter Kurtz.
Uh-huh.
He actually did my headshot for my favorite headshot. But anyway, I just like clicked with him when he, you know, when we did the photo shoot, and like, you know, he comes to see my plays and stuff. And I didn't realize like how many of my plays he'd actually come to see until we were like at this one play and he was discussing literally every single one of my plays. And I was like, oh, you've seen a lot of my play. So, you know, we just like, we'll hang out, like I'll call him up. I'm like, what are you doing today? You want to have lunch? You know, like whatever. I just hang out with him because I like him, you know?
Yeah.
And then he, randomly, because he takes photographs for, like, all different kinds of people, you know? And he, you know, photographed producer Stephanie Elaine, who, she produces Broadway stuff. She did The Color Purple. Mm-hmm. She did that Tennessee Williams, what was the Streetcar.
Uh-huh.
But then she's also like a film producer, also. And Mark was like, "Oh, you two don't know each other, and you should." And wow. He's like, "So I just gave her your contact information. So if you hear from her, you know."
Right.
And I was like, "Oh, okay, cool." And sure enough, she did reach out and was like, "So yes, so Mark Woodcock, like,
right,
recommended that I contact you because you're a writer that I should know." And then, you know, I sent her some samples. She really liked them. And we've been working together for like 2 years now.
That's
on various
amazing.
Projects. And it's
That's
crazy,
amazing.
Like how community works in theater.
Yeah.
You know, because he's my photographer friend, you know, like you don't.
Right.
You know, you don't think of.
Right. It's not a transactional relationship.
Yeah.
Right?
It's
like
just
where the expectation is, I'll do something for you, you do something
yeah,
for me.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And I find that like most of the people that I just like and
yeah.
that who I just gravitate toward and whose work I respect, you know, it just so happens that it's reciprocal. And they're like, oh, I should recommend you to such and such. And
yeah.
then they do. And
I love that kind of advocacy.
Yeah.
The advocacy that just comes out of nowhere and
yes.
is not expected. And
it's so surprising.
Someone's just thinking of an opportunity for somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that so much.
Yes, right? And I'm like in a place where I'm like, I want to do that for other people, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, who do I know who's like,
yeah.
who would be a great match for this theater? Or who has a script that I think could really work for this particular company? Or,
yeah.
you know what I mean? Like, I find myself wanting to like, also do that for like other writers that,
yeah.
that I really love and respect, and actors that I really like
right.
working with, you know? Unfortunately, it works in the other direction too, where it's like, ooh, actors who were like maybe divas.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
But for the most part, it's all love, man. It's all love.
So we only have a few minutes left,
oh.
and I want to ask a couple questions about NNPN since we're sitting
yeah.
here. We're at the NNPN showcase
mm-hmm.
in Sacramento, and I'm curious to hear. Can you talk about how your relationship to NNPN, having a Rolling World premiere and being in a showcase this year, and all of these people from around the country coming in to see your work, can you talk about how that impacts your career?
Oh, I don't know yet. I mean, not the showcase. It does feel, I feel optimistic, you know? I just had my reading last night,
mm-hmm.
and I think it went really well, and people seem to respond to it really, really pretty strongly, which is encouraging. I have, however, had that it happen before.
Yeah.
You know, just in other places, not at NNPN. So I'm trying not to get too souped. Like, I'm trying not to get too hype, you know? over
is
it
like,
or,
is it like this tantalizing possibility?
It is, but again, like, I'm really trying not to put too much pressure
yeah.
on it, or I mean, I will be, I'm not gonna lie, like, I would be disappointed, like, if it, you know, three theaters, if I couldn't get three theaters to, like, agree to produce the play.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would be sad. but yeah, like, I have yet to see how it translates, because again, like, I do have those plays that like have been read everywhere and
right.
everybody seems to respond to them in really sort of strong ways. Yeah, so, you know, I feel hopeful. I feel like it is a little bit different. I feel like people are a little more decisive or a little more committed or something to walking away with a play that they can take with them.
Like they're shopping.
Yeah, like they're shopping.
But they need some. They need to take. They need to get something.
Yeah, like they're not just window shopping. It's like no, we're gonna.
I'm walking. I need a pair of shoes. Yes. I don't know if it's these shoes or those shoes or those
exactly.
shoes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's that. Like there's a very sort of serious. There's a serious shopper. They're in serious shopper mode.
Yeah.
So that's encouraging, and I just hope that the play, you know, that the work speaks to them enough to, you know, to have them go, yeah, that one. I'd like to bring that back.
Yeah. I hope it happens for you.
Me too.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed your reading. I was in an airplane.
Oh, you poor thing.
But thank you for taking some time. I know you're super busy this weekend, and I really appreciate having a chance to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm like still a little bit like, oh, okay. we can talk, okay.
And we did. We just talked for an hour.
We did. I hope I didn't yap your ear off.
No, you didn't. Okay. No, it was great.
I hope it was all relevant. I get off on tangents really easily.
The tangents are where the good stuff hides.
Tell that to my students. I think they would beg to differ.
Thank you to Chisa and thank you to NNPN for setting this all up. I'm excited to share the super National New Play Network episode with you in the very near future. If you're in New York City, go see Chisa's play, Surely Goodness and Mercy. It's running through April 13th at Keen Company. That's K-E-E-N. Go to keencompany.org for tickets and all that. And her monologue play, Proof of Love, commissioned by Audible and co-produced by New York Theatre Workshop, will be playing at Minetta Lane beginning May 7th. So be on the watch for that. I have no doubt it will be an amazing piece of theater. The music at the beginning of this episode is from Dr. Turtle. The music you're hearing right now is from Poddington Bear. The theme song for the subtext is by International Pen Pal. The subtext is produced, edited, and hosted by me, and presented by American Theatre Magazine, a program of Theatre Communications Group. Thank you to Rob and Deep at American Theatre Magazine for all you do in supporting the theatre community and making the magazine go. Thank you for listening. The play filling me up this month is Rain and Zoe Save the World by Crystal Skillman. This play is powerfully fun, funny, and deep. It's got great roles for young actors. It's such an amazing play, dear world. Go produce it.